The water poured over the edge of the dam in an arc that cleared them by several meters. Kiar got a packet of cigarettes out from his jacket pocket and lit one with a lighter that he then returned to a trouser pocket. He scoured the surroundings before taking a step forwards and leaning against the side of the bridge. "What's your deal with Pia?" he asked. Henning watched the water thundering down below them, then carry on to a quieter stretch as the river headed towards the city. He positioned himself closer to Kiar. "I know what's at stake for you both," he said. "I've promised not to write about anything you tell me, on the condition that you tell me everything." The policeman gave him a disconsolate look. "I don't really have much to tell." "You changed the Indicia report about Tor Pulley from the 11th of September 2007, the evening I lost my son." Kiar shook his head.
"Not exactly," he said.
Henning turned towards him. "What do you mean?"
"I didn't change anything."
The muscles in Kiar's face tensed. Henning waited for him to continue.
"You know that they threatened me. My family. They wanted access to Indicia."
"Yes,"
Kiar sighed. "The bloke who called spoke Swedish with an Eastern European accent. I don't know his name. After they'd killed the dog, I agreed to meet him one evening, and I managed to sneak a laptop out from the station, one that I knew had Indicia installed." Kiar took a last draw on his cigarette and then threw it into the water. He scrutinized the trees along the river, as though he expected someone unwelcome to jump out at any moment. "We agreed that I would get a room at the Scandic Hotel out in Asker, and that I would wait there for 5 knocks on the door, which I did. And I opened the door to 2 men who looked more or less the same. Quite short, strong. They both had guns. They were both wearing hoodies."
Henning thought about the 2 men that the police wanted to talk to in connection with Ivar's murder. Kiar's description was almost the same.
"I'd managed to get Pia's username and password, and I'd already logged on to Indicia when we sat down. The man who spoke Swedish took over the computer, while the other one made sure that I couldn't see what they were doing on the screen."
Henning listened carefully to every word Kiar said.
"But I did manage to see that he went into a report, and that there wasn't much written there, maybe 5 or 6 lines, only I couldn't see what it said."
Again, Kiar looked round. There was no one nearby.
"So I don't know what he deleted."
Henning considered what he'd said.
"Do you think you'd recognize them if you saw a picture of them?"
Kiar took his time.
"Possibly," he said. "I don't know. Let's put it this way. I tried to have as little eye contact with them as possible."
Henning thought about the report after the fire in his flat, which concluded that the cause of the fire was unknown. The cursory, routine police investigation had found nothing. And by the time Henning had felt strong enough to start asking questions himself, the Indicia report, the details, had been changed.
"When was this?" "You mean, when did it happen?"
"Hmm." Kiar squinted up to the left. "Now, when was it? Let me think. Some weeks ago, maybe? Maybe more?"
"Some weeks."
So that meant the information hadn't been considered dangerous or incriminating until 2 years after the report was written. About the time that Henning had finally reached a point when he thought he had no choice but to examine the circumstances of his son's death. About the time that Tor Pulley had been killed and about the time that Henning himself had had two attempts on his life, which meant that the information in itself was worth the risk of threatening a policeman and all that that entailed, and that it was urgent. They stood together, looking around for a few moments. Henning remembered the patrol car Kjaer had sent to Mark Vian that evening, where Pulley was sitting, monitoring Henning's movements. He also knew that the police had checked Pulley's car, and, knowing who Pulley was, and wondering why he was sitting in the same place several nights in a row, thought it necessary to report the fact.
Was there any spoken communication between you and the patrol officer who wrote the report about Pulley being on Markvian those few evenings? He asked.
Kjaer shook his head.
But then, I didn't ask for any particular feedback. If there had been anything important, I would have heard about it.
So, the fact that my flat went up in flames 10 minutes later wasn't important enough? You didn't think that there might be a connection?
Kjaer looked at Henning.
Fires happen all the time in this town, You have no idea how many call-outs we get every day, every night, and as a rule it's just someone who's forgotten to turn off the hot plate. It would be easy enough to miss it, especially as it's not the force's primary responsibility.
But it was shoddy police work all the same, Henning thought, not to check Indicia for any details that had been reported that evening. That should be standard procedure. They were both silent for a few moments.
Is there anything else you'd like to know?
Kjaer then asked. Henning thought about it.
Just one thing, he said. You said that he deleted something.
Kjaer wrinkled his nose.
Just now, you said you didn't know what he deleted.
How do you know that he deleted something? How do you know that he didn't just change the details instead?
Well, the policeman shifted his weight. I just assumed he'd deleted something because...
He seemed to think about it.
I heard the keyboard. You can hear the difference between someone writing something and someone deleting something, or moving up and down through the text with arrows, for that matter.
Henning considered this claim and agreed that he was probably right.
And you were sitting beside him when he was doing this? How long did it take?
Kjaer shook his head.
All of a sudden, he looked more alert. When I think about it, it was actually really quick. Just a few taps on the keyboard, I'm guessing the arrow keys, and then a firm, decisive click, as though something was being deleted. And that was that. They got up and left.
Henning thought through what Kjaer had just said. No more than a few taps. What could be so important that it had to be removed, and yet it didn't take more than a moment to delete? The answer was simple. A name. Tor Pulley had not been alone in the car that evening. Chapter 24. 25 minutes after Andreas Kjaer had continued his run, Henning got into Ivar's car, sweaty and tired. He didn't start the car straight away, but instead rested his hands on the wheel and took some deep breaths. He removed his mobile phone from the glove compartment and saw that Bjarne had called and that he'd sent him a text message as well.
"Booked an interrogation room for 2 p.m. Good if you could come a bit before. B.B.
Henning looked at his watch. Nearly 11:30. Going to Turnsberg and back would take about 3.5 hours, probably even longer, but he would rather do that than hang around killing time at the police headquarters. So Henning didn't answer the text. Then, just as he was about to put his key in the ignition, something caught his attention. Ivor's car was full of rubbish. Old newspapers, half-empty bottles, coins and squashed cigarette packets. And on top of some old parking tickets in the mid-console lay a business card that made Henning very curious indeed. Preben Merck, the lawyer. The man Henning suspected was Daddy Longlegs. When had Ivor got that? Henning checked the parking tickets under the card. One of them prompted him to start the car and head towards the centre of Oslo. Tønsberg would have to wait for the moment. Preben Merck's office was no more than a stone's throw from the Oslo courthouse, and when Henning arrived, the lawyer was not around. His secretary, a woman with long dark hair who was sitting straight-backed like a priestess, told him that Merck would probably be back in about 15 minutes. He'd gone out to meet a client, she said, and had called only minutes ago to say he would be a little delayed. I don't think he has time to speak to you today, she continued. His schedule is... Not to worry, Henning interrupted. I just have a quick question for him. Then I leave. The secretary scowled at him, but Henning turned away before she made any further attempt to get rid of him. Preben Merck was lawyer to the wealthy Hellberg family from Tønsberg, and Henning had met him there briefly when suspicion fell on the mother of the family, Uni Hellberg. There was evidence to indicate that she had orchestrated the death of her sister-in-law Ellen 16 years earlier, and that she had contracted Tor Pulli to carry out the murder. Henning thought it highly unlikely that a woman like Uni, who hardly frequented the criminal underworld, would have contacted Tor Pulli herself. She had presumably used a middleman, someone she knew and trusted, who in turn knew who to contact. The family lawyer, for example, whom she'd known for years. And Tore was a childhood friend of Uni's son, William, as was Charlie Highseater. So it was more than likely that Merck, who had spent a lot of time with the family over the years, knew both Tore and Charlie. Henning approached the secretary again. How does it work? He asked when he got to the reception desk. Do you make a note of everyone who comes to see Merck? You mean some kind of log? She shook her head. We're only a small firm, and as you saw for yourself, there's no reception downstairs, so if you're wondering if I know who's been here... Well, I've got Merck's diary... Most people who come actually have an appointment. Henning ignored the thinly veiled criticism. Instead, he looked over at a small stack of business cards on the desk. He picked one up and studied the gilt lettering that said, Preben Merck, lawyer. Well, if I wanted to know who was here on Friday, could you tell me? He put the card down again and gave her the most charming smile he could muster. In principle, yes, but I'm afraid I can't.
Oh, that's a shame. Perhaps you could tell me, then, if someone like me came by on Friday, who didn't have an appointment.
The secretary hesitated before saying, I wasn't here on Friday.
That's a shame, too.
Just then, the door opened, and Henning smiled broadly at the lawyer, who walked in. He stopped in his tracks as soon as he saw Henning. Preben Merck was wearing a full-length coat with a navy blue scarf round his neck, which he hung up on the coat stand. He put his briefcase down and placed his coat on a hanger.
"Hello, Mr. Merck," Henning said, while wondering at the same time if this could really be Daddy Longlegs, who gave jobs to people like Erjan Mjerns and Durim Redzepi, this tall man who looked utterly harmless. In fact, he didn't even look like a lawyer, more like a man who hated wearing suits and didn't fit the one he was wearing.
The jacket was a few sizes too big, and his thin arms seemed to drown in the sleeves.
My secretary has undoubtedly already told you that I don't have time to...
Yes, she has, Henning said. I leave right away. I just wanted to ask one quick question, if that's okay. Maybe two.
He smiled as disarmingly as he could. Merck took a deep breath.
Be quick, then. I've got a teleconference in...
He looked at the clock.
4 minutes,
his secretary piped up behind Henning. Merck picked up his briefcase again, and then stood about a meter away from Henning.
So, how can I help you?
Henning studied him for a moment. Is he alarmed to see me? Nervous? Nothing in his eyes or demeanor gave anything away. Merck just stood there, waiting for his questions.
You've no doubt heard that a colleague of mine was killed yesterday, Henning said.
Ivar Gundersen?
Yes, of course, Merck replied. Terrible business. My condolences.
Thank you. I just wondered if you'd ever met him personally.
Merck didn't answer straight away.
If I'd met Ivar Gundersen?
Yes.
He thought about it.
Very possibly. After all, was a journalist.
Why?
Has he ever been here?
Henning indicated the office. Again, Merck took a moment to think.
Why do you ask?
Well, has he or hasn't he?
No,
Merck said. Not that I can remember.
Henning studied his face.
Okay, he said.
That's it. No more questions.
Really?
The lawyer laughed. Journalists seldom run out of questions, Yule, so is that really all you wanted to know? And what does that mean, the day after your colleague was killed?
Nothing at all, Merck. I was just curious. I know that he came to see someone around here on Friday, and that he parked just up the street. But that, of course, doesn't mean it was you he came to see.
Thank you for taking the time. You better make sure you don't miss your conference call now.
Henning smiled, turned, and headed to the door.
Bye, he said. See you again, no doubt.
He closed the door behind him, but didn't go down the stairs to the street. Instead, he pulled out the ticket he'd found in Ivor's car, from the same car park where he'd parked only half an hour ago, which showed that Ivar had been there only last Friday. And Merck's business card had been on top of all the rubbish in Ivor's car, and the card looked just as new as the one he'd just seen in the office. Ivar was here on Friday, Henning thought. Everything seemed to point to that. So why hadn't Preben Merck admitted it? And what was Ivar doing here?
Chapter 25. Bjarne called again just as Henning drove out of the Harneclive tunnel on the road to Turnsberg. He pulled into the inside lane behind a silver Nissan Primera and picked up his phone.
Where are you? Bjarne asked. Sounds like you're in a car.
Yes, Henning said.
I'm going to meet someone.
Right. And who would that be?
I'm going to see if I can get hold of William Hellberg.
There was silence for a beat.
But he lives in Turnsberg.
Henning didn't answer.
Did you not see the message I sent you earlier on today?
Bjarne asked, his tone more aggressive.
Yes, but I was already on my way, Henning lied. Can we not do it later in the afternoon, 4-ish or thereabouts?
Bjarne sighed. Henning could hear from the background noise that the policeman was in the office. He heard a mouse click.
I'll see if we can delay a bit, Bjarne said. But get back as soon as you can. I'm not the only one waiting for you here.
I'll do my best, Henning said. How's the investigation going?
Have the two guys you wanted to speak to come forward?
No.
One of them sounds like Durim Redzepi, Henning said. Do you remember I told you about him? There was another silence.
He's one of the people we're checking up on, of course, Bjarne said.
Lies, Henning thought, but he didn't confront him with it. I have to go now, he said. I'm nearly in Turnsberg.
Okay. Come back as soon as you can, then. Will do.
William Hellberg lived in a highly desirable area on an island close to Turnsberg, where each house was bigger and grander than the next. Hellberg's large black SUV took up the greater part of the cobbled driveway in front of the house where he lived. Henning parked beside a manicured hedge and rang the bell. A thin woman in her 30s opened the door. Her lips were dry, her eyes were swollen, and she was wearing no makeup.
Hi, Henning said, and introduced himself. Is William at home?
She tilted her head and looked up at him.
What's it about? She asked. It's about a case I'm working on, Henning said. I work for 123 News. I dropped by William's office in Turnsberg, and they said he was working from home today.
What case? Henning wondered for a moment if she was Hellberg's personal secretary, but then he noticed the diamond ring on her finger and the fact that she wasn't exactly wearing office clothes. Jeans, a white top, and a grey woolen cardigan. It was Hellberg's wife.
It involves a few things, Henning said, including a murder.
The colour drained from the woman's cheeks.
Murder? She said, and pulled the cardigan tighter. What on earth would William have to do with that?
Nothing,
Henning assured her quickly. But he does know some of the people who might be involved,
from a while back, in his past.
The woman nodded slowly, studying him.
Did you say your name was Yul?
One moment. I'll see if he's got time to talk to you. The woman pushed the door to without closing it and disappeared into the house. Henning took a step back. The well-maintained lawn around the house still looked remarkably green and summery, although the scattering of leaves showed it was definitely autumn. And the house gleamed white, even though it was a grey day. The driveway looked like it had just been swept, and a moped was parked next to the garage. Presumably, it belonged to the son. It took a few minutes before the woman returned.
Please, come inside and wait, she said in a rather thin voice. He's on the phone.
Great, thank you, Henning said, as he followed her inside.
Hellberg's wife showed him into the living room, where he sat down on a generous sofa and placed his arms on the wide leather armrests. It made him feel he was lording it up, so he folded his hands on his lap instead.
Nice house, he commented.
Thank you, she said.
Lived here long?
She paused before answering.
6 years.
She moved a tablet that was lying on the sofa and put it down on a small table in the corner, by an armchair that looked like it might be an expensive antique.
Would you like a cup of coffee while you wait?
She asked, without looking at him.
Yes, please. I'd love one.
The unnamed woman swiftly disappeared into the kitchen. A couple of minutes later, she came back with a cup and saucer that she put down on the table in front of him, the porcelain clinking. Her hands were shaking.
I've had a little too much coffee today, she said, apologetically. It always makes my hands...
She gave them a little shake and tried to smile. The colour that had drained from her face a little while ago had still not returned. She looked ill, Henning thought, and for a second he felt slightly guilty to have barged in like this. He took a sip of coffee.
It's tempting to drink too much coffee when it tastes this good,
he said and smiled. Are you also working from home today?
No, I'm not working, she said. I only work on Thursdays and Saturdays.
Henning nodded. Where do you work?
In a children's clothes shop in Turnsburg. I need something to do as well.
The woman gave another cautious smile. Henning could well imagine it. The Helberg family was very wealthy, so even though she probably didn't need any extra income, it no doubt helped her self-esteem to contribute a little. Polishing the family silver must be pretty boring in the long run. She pushed her shoulders back ever so slightly when her husband came into the room. Henning turned to greet William Helberg, who came towards him with his hand out and a smile.
Henning, he said. How nice to see you again. What are you doing down here?
It was less than a week since they'd last spoken, at the hospital in Turnsburg, after Henning and Ivor had found William Helberg's missing sister, mainly thanks to Nora. The gratitude and friendliness that Helberg had shown Henning then did not appear to have waned.
Hello, Henning said, standing up.
They shook hands.
Sorry to disturb you at home, he said. I'm the one who should apologize for making you wait so long, Helberg said. How are you?
Henning gave a fleeting thought to Ivor, but tried not to show it.
Not too bad, thanks. And you?
Well, yes, I'm fine. Thank you. Helberg glanced over at his wife. The past few weeks have been rather demanding, what with Mother and, well, all the rest, he said. Which is why I'm working from home today. There's so much going on in the office at the moment, though it has started to quieten down now.
Of course.
They looked at each other for a few seconds. Then Helberg stepped past him.
And Cecily, could you maybe get me a cup of coffee too?
Helberg gave his best salesman smile as he watched his wife go into the kitchen without a word. He sat down opposite Henning.
So, Helberg said, the leather sofa squeaking under him. What brings you to Turnsburg again, Henning? Are you looking for somewhere to live?
Henning shook his head.
I'm here because of your lawyer, he said, among other things.
Helberg's salesman's smile disappeared, and he frowned.
Preben?
Henning nodded. The sound of a coffee machine could be heard from the kitchen.
And why's that? Helberg said.
Henning didn't answer his question, and instead posed his own.
How well do you know him?
Helberg looked surprised, then laughed a little.
I know Preben very well, of course. He's been the family lawyer for many, many years. Why do you ask?
Helberg gave him a searching look. On his way to Turnsburg, Henning had wondered about how far he should go. He was taking a chance by airing his suspicions based on nothing but speculation, but then again, he didn't have much time, and none of his potential sources were overly friendly. So he shared his theory with Helberg, namely that Merck had been Uni Helberg's contact with Tor Pulli in connection with the Ellen Helberg murder, and it was very likely that he was also the middleman for several other criminals in Oslo. When Henning had finished, Helberg shook his head and said,
That's an absurd theory, Henning. I know Preben to be a good man through and through, and I find it hard to believe that he would be involved in anything like that.
A moment later, Helberg's wife came back into the living room with a cup of fresh coffee. The cup was bigger and thicker than his, and didn't have a saucer, but she held it with both hands. She gave it to Helberg without looking at either of them. Her hands were no longer shaking.
Thank you, darling.
He smiled up at her. And Cecily Helberg retreated again, and William followed her with his eyes.
But then,
Henning started as soon as they were alone,
do you know of anyone else who your mother could have trusted in that situation?
Helberg took a sip of coffee.
No, but, he shook his head, but it still sounds utterly far-fetched. Hellberg met Henning's eye. Have you told your theory to the police? There was an aggressive edge to his voice now.
No, Henning said. Not yet.
He took a sip of coffee and looked at Hellberg. The man wore a suit, even at home. He was running a hand over one side of his head, pressing his shoulder-length, slicked black hair even more neatly into place. He got up and paced back and forth. Henning wondered if he should mention Ivor's possible visit to Preben Merck, but decided against it. Instead, he moved the conversation onto a different track.
The last time we met Hellberg, we talked a bit about Tore and Charlie and the fact that they'd fallen out over a flat in Natal.
Hellberg was apparently still lost in his own thoughts. Sorry? Henning repeated what he'd just said.
Yes, yes, I remember that.
Can you tell me anything about them? Hellberg frowned. About Tore and Charlie? He took a few steps back towards Henning and sat down on the sofa again.
I'm trying to get a better understanding of their relationship, Henning explained. How serious the conflict might be. I know that they did a lot together and that they'd done some deals that were not entirely legal, but do you know if Tore was involved in Charlie's business in Natal as well?
Hellberg looked up at him.
How would that work? Henning shrugged. I don't know.
Hellberg shook his head.
I very much doubt it. Tora certainly never said anything about it to me.
Both were silent. Hellberg took some careful sips of coffee, and Henning wondered how to further the conversation.
So, Tora beat Charlie up at some point because of the flat we were talking about. And they had no contact after that until Tore was killed?
Not as far as I know, no, Hellberg said.
But I don't get it, Henning said. Was that all?
Hellberg didn't seem to understand his question.
Let me put it another way. I've been thinking about this, Henning said. And I can't quite believe that the argument they had was only about a flat.
Hellberg held up the palms of his hands as if to say, I have no idea.
I haven't spoken to Charlie for a long time, he said, so I don't know. But surely they disagreed or argued about other things before? Had Tore never thumped him before?
No, I don't think I ever heard either say anything bad about the other, Hellberg said with a faint smile. And even if Charlie could be a complete bastard when he was younger, he would never have dared cross Tore.
Henning put down his cup. Tell me more, he urged Hellberg. What were they like when they were young?
Hellberg breathed in and gazed up to the left, then smiled.
Tore was naturally the center of attention, he said. Wherever we went, he was incredibly charismatic. The women...
Hellberg's smile broadened. Then he shook his head.
Tore was a classic leader, took up a lot of space, and people listened to him. If there was any disagreement about where we should go or what we should do, Tore decided, and we did what we were told.
He paused for thought.
I imagine it can't have been easy for Charlie always to be overruled and steamrolled. But you should ask him yourself.
I've tried to get hold of him, Henning said.
He doesn't answer his phone.
Hellberg shrugged. Charlie might like being the one who has the final say, Henning thought. The one with power. And at the time, Tore was struggling with money and debt, and Charlie's pockets were full. But that still didn't explain why Tore had floored him. Veronica knew nothing about it either. She'd never met Charlie. Henning asked Hellberg if there was anything else he could tell him about his two friends.
No, I'm not sure that there is, he said.
Henning waited a moment, in case more memories resurfaced. Then he finished his coffee and stood up.
"I won't take up any more of your time, then," he said. "But if you do think of anything in relation to what we've talked about, I'd really appreciate it if you got in touch."
Hellberg stood up as well. His face was thoughtful.
"There's no point in going any further with your Praben theory, I'm sure of that. He's solid."
"Perhaps," Henning said. "But if you do think of anything, anything at all, it's easiest to get hold of me by email."
Henning didn't want to give out his mobile number unless it was strictly necessary.
"Right you are." Hellberg gestured for Henning to go first. He put on his shoes in the hall and then turned towards Hellberg.
"Thank you for the coffee. Sorry to bother you again."
They shook hands.
"My pleasure," Hellberg said. "It really was no bother at all."
Henning turned back and opened the door, then walked out into the day. The clouds were higher, and the sharp light hurt his eyes. Hellberg followed him out onto the step.
"Let me know if you ever consider moving down here, and I'll sort out a good house for you."
Henning looked over his shoulder at Hellberg and saw that the smile was back on his face.
"I'll certainly do that," he said.
Chapter 26. On the way back to Oslo, Henning thought about what Hellberg would do now, if he would challenge his lawyer straight away, or if he would choose not to. Henning guessed it would be the latter. It was just a theory, and regardless of whether it was true or not, it was dynamite enough to destroy the trust that had been built up over the years, perhaps even a friendship. And there had been too many scandals in the Hellberg family recently. Henning found it hard to believe that William Hellberg would want to create even more fuss without substantial proof. Henning checked his mobile phone and saw that Bjarne had booked a room for 4 o'clock. That meant that he had plenty of time, even if there were traffic jams and delays on the way into the capital. He didn't make any effort to get back faster, and instead looked around at the fields that stretched out on either side of the road as he drove. He saw some smoke snaking up from a chimney in the distance. It made him think of winter, which was fast approaching, the worst time of year in Norway, when darkness forced people indoors and curtains were drawn. He wondered if he would be here when the snow came, or if the people who had killed Ivar would get him as well. They'd already tried a couple of times. Henning had never dwelled on the idea of his own death before Jonas was born. But when he became a father, all that changed, and he thought about it every day. He didn't want to die. Yet death wasn't as frightening anymore. He'd even found himself longing for it, a way to find peace. He thought about what he would do if he survived the next few days and weeks, if he would stay in Oslo, if he could cope with being near to Nora and watching the child grow up, if he would continue to work as a journalist. As he passed the toll booths at Fornebu, a thought struck him. He was sitting in Ivar's car, a car that Ivar had obviously used a fair bit recently. And even though it was an old model, it still had an electronic pass that registered every time the car went through the tolls. Henning made a mental note to mention it to Bjarne when they met. There was no way of knowing whether it would tell him anything other than that Ivar had been out and about in Oslo, but it was worth checking. Nora was lying on the sofa, half dozing, when the doorbell rang. The loud noise made her start, and she sat up and looked around. She'd been lying there all night, and all day. She hadn't dared go to bed, scared that she would still be able to smell Ivar on the sheet or pillow, scared that she might find a sock or a T-shirt that was his. The book on his bedside table, The House of the Mosque by Kader Abdullah, was a book she'd given him.
She knew that the very sight of it would make her cry, and she couldn't bear it. She'd cried enough. She pushed back the blanket, put her feet down on the floor, and shuffled her way slowly to the intercom out in the hall.
Hello?
Hello. It's Bjarne Brogeland.
The police? No, she couldn't face that now.
Can I come up?
He asked. Nora didn't answer.
It'll only take a couple of minutes,
he added. Nora sighed and put a hand to her forehead, which suddenly felt very hot. She moved her hand to her hip, which had gained some extra padding in recent weeks. She pressed the button and listened to the buzz at the other end.
Thank you.
Nora put the receiver back in its cradle and stood there waiting for 20 seconds until there was another ring. She pressed the button again, then opened the door, leaving it ajar. She would normally have panicked and looked around to make sure the flat was presentable, but her mother had done nothing but tidy before she left for work. There was a gentle knock on the door, then Bjarne opened it and came in. He gave her a grave nod and said hello.
Hi,
Nora replied. Bjarne closed the door behind him and stood there looking at her. Nora couldn't deal with his concern, so she pushed herself away from the wall and went into the living room. She heard Bjarne take off his shoes in the hall and then follow her in.
How are you?
He asked. She didn't answer.
Ah, sorry, he said. Stupid question.
They sat down on either side of the coffee table.
Have you noticed the officers that are watching you?
He asked.
No.
Good, he said and smiled. That means they're doing their job.
He pulled a notebook out of his jacket pocket.
I have to ask you some questions about Ivor. I hope that's all right.
Bjarne's voice was so soft and warm that it had her on the verge of tears. She nodded.
Yesterday, Bjarne said. Ivor was here with you in the morning, wasn't he? But he went back to his flat pretty early. Is that right?
She nodded.
Did he say what he was going to do?
She shook her head. Only that he had to work.
Do you know what he was working on?
She shook her head.
And you didn't ask?
Yes, I did, but he didn't tell me. Nora heard how hard her voice was when she said that.
He didn't mention it the evening before, or anything else in the past few days.
She shook her head again.
But he was very distracted, so I realized he was busy with something. Something big enough for him to want to work on a Sunday morning.
Bjarne scribbled a few words down in his notebook.
But otherwise there was nothing about his behavior that might indicate he was in trouble or having problems.
Nora shook her head.
He didn't seem to be frightened or anxious.
No.
Just thinking about a normal day, an evening like any other together with Ivor, made Nora's stomach start to knot. She straightened up and tried not to think about the fact that she'd gone to bed only half an hour after he'd arrived, partly because she was nauseous and tired, but mainly because he was so much later than he'd said he would be.
It's possible,
the reservation in Bjarne's voice made her look up,
that Ivor was working with Henning on something,
Bjarne said,
in connection with the fire in his flat.
The thought had been lurking just below the surface since she found Ivor, but she hadn't allowed herself to think about it. Not until now. She felt a surge of anger through her body, so powerful that she couldn't say anything.
He didn't mention anything to you.
She immediately shook her head.
Did he talk about Henning at all?
She knew what she wanted to say, but it was none of Bjarne's business that Ivor seemed to be more concerned about Henning than her.
Have you spoken to Henning since...
Nora shook her head again.
Then a long silence ensued. Bjarne leaned in towards the table.
What about Rasmus Bjelland? Did Ivar ever mention that name?
She looked up at him again. Who's that? She asked.
A joiner, Bjarne replied. That's to say, he certainly used to be one.
What about him?
I don't know, Bjarne said, and tried to smile.
He looked at his notebook and the few words he'd written down. Did this Bjelland man have anything to do with Ivar's murder, Nora wondered, or the fire at Henning's flat?
It's just a name that's cropped up, Bjarne said. Needn't mean anything at all. But you've never heard of him?
No. A heavy silence filled the flat for the next 30 seconds, until Bjarne's telephone started to ring.
Chapter 27. Henning was glad to find a free parking space on the street below police headquarters. The stop-start drive into the center had worn him out, so he was grateful that he didn't have far to walk. He looked at his watch. 4:05. He locked Ivar's car and was hurrying towards the zebra crossing when he noticed a car crawling next to the pavement. The sun was reflecting on the windscreen, but Henning could see that there were two men inside. The window on the passenger side was open. When Henning saw an arm reach out, he at first assumed that the man in the passenger seat wanted to ask him for directions or something. Then he saw the gun, and it was pointing straight at him, and he understood what was about to happen. The man holding the weapon was called Durim Redzepi, and he was an experienced killer, perhaps the one who killed Ivar. And now he'd found Henning, too. Henning quickly looked around for somewhere to hide, something to grab and use as a weapon or protection. But no, it was at least 5 meters to the nearest car or barrier. There was nowhere to hide, no one nearby to help him. A moment later, he felt a sharp stab in his chest, a force strong enough to spin him halfway round before a second projectile grazed his ear. But Henning didn't register anything more, as he was already falling backwards. Downwards. Towards the ground. The sudden acceleration pressed Durim Redzepi back against the seat, but he managed to poke his head out of the window and look back. He caught a glimpse of Henning Yule lying on the pavement. He wasn't moving. He hadn't fired the best shots, and the distance was greater than it should have been. But there wasn't time. There were cars behind them, and Yule would have suspected something if the car had been just waiting by the pavement. The question was, how good his aim had been. He had definitely hit him, though. He was sure of that. Jeton Pokoli pressed the pedal to the floor, and it wasn't long before the police station disappeared behind them. They jumped the lights at Schweigard's gate and tore on towards Turin, past the prison, then up to Karl Berner's Platz.
"Is there anyone behind us?" Pokoli shouted.
"Don't think so," Redzepi said. "Stop driving so fast."
Pokoli slowed down. They merged with the traffic, and then had to stop at a red light by the Munch Museum. They both kept a vigilant eye on the side mirrors. Soon, they heard sirens.
"Drive upwards towards Erken,"
Redzepi said, clutching his gun. Bockerly did as he was told. As soon as the lights changed to green, they roared up the hill, past the public baths on the left, and then very quickly, they were surrounded by trees.
"We have to dump the car,"
Pokoli said. Redzepi nodded, but his thoughts were elsewhere. Yule had seen him. Just before he fired, their eyes had met. So it was more important than ever that they'd succeeded this time.
Chapter 28.
What do you say, Mr. High? Nice, eh? Good?
Charlie Highseater looked at himself in the mirror. The white suit fitted neatly around the shoulders, arms and legs, just as it should. The shirt underneath, also white, was stiff and smooth. Elegant.
No, no, no,
Mariana had said the last time he tried on a similar outfit. You look like a snowman. Okay, so you're Norwegian, we can see that, but you need something that complements your beautiful eyes. A blue shirt, for example, and a grey suit. Charlie was, of course, perfectly aware that his eyes were blue, but he hadn't known that she'd noticed them, or liked them. And later, when he'd changed into something else, she'd come right up to him, pulled down the shirt sleeves so they peeped out from under the sleeves of his jacket, and her tiny fingers had stroked his skin. Then she'd taken a step back and studied him. Perfect. He hadn't been sure if she was talking about the suit or him, but he'd thought a lot about it later. Whatever the case, he'd bought two suits and shirts in the colours that Mariana had chosen, and he had bought her a dress, too, as a kind of bonus. But there was no Mariana to help him now. No assistant who knew what was needed before he knew it himself. And when he'd stood on the beach after her wedding to Bjelland some years later, he'd felt something he'd never felt before. Not for any woman. The feeling that he'd done something wrong. That he'd made a mistake. That he'd not grabbed the opportunity before it was too late. The chance to have Mariana for himself. To make her his wife. Instead of Bjelland's. And when she'd come over to him and thanked him for the gift and his blessing, that he was fine with the fact that they'd started up in the same business. She'd seen it in his eyes. She knew him so well after working with him for 3 years. She knew her and Bjelland being in the same business wasn't the problem. Her now being Bjelland's wife was. Deep down, she knew he loved her. And when, a few seconds later, she gave him a hug, her hair had brushed his neck, light as a feather, and her skin had smelled of lavender, of the sea, and a different future. Without him. One that he now realized he yearned for. The wedding party had carried on through the night and late into the morning, but Charlie had gone home early. He'd sat on another beach and gazed out over the ocean with the scent of lavender in his nose. And when he heard several months later that she was dead, he'd wept for the first time that he could remember. He'd been angry. He'd felt the need to take out his anger on someone, which was why he'd taken a rare trip home to Norway, which was why he'd argued with Tora. Again. They had, for a while, disagreed about money. But when Tora had asked him again if there was anything that would make him change his mind about the damned flat, Charlie had replied, in an invincible rush of cocaine, that he might consider it, if Tora would give him a night with Veronica. He hadn't meant it, not really. And even though they'd shared women before, he should have known that those days were long gone, and that the rules were different when it came to Veronica. The next thing he remembered was waking up with a jaw that was broken in the same precise way that had become so famous when Tora worked as an enforcer that the staff at Ullevål Hospital had named it after him.
What do you say, Mr. High?
The question jolted him out of his memories. He rubbed the scar on his chin and looked at himself in the mirror.
I need something darker, he said. I look like a snowman in this shit.
Mr. High. Charlie had liked the nickname to begin with. There was humour in it, as no one in Brazil managed to pronounce Highseater, and it said something about who he was and how far he'd got in the years that he'd lived in Natal. But it had other connotations that he liked less and less. That he was high on drugs, as if he needed to do that anymore. Charlie had had his last line of coke at the Odeon the evening that Tora broke his jaw.
Freddy was sitting in the Mercedes when Charlie was done with his shopping.
That went well then, boss? He asked. Looks like you've got 2 or even 3 suits.
2, Charlie replied.
Only 2 this time.
He got into the car and they drove off. The car's suspension worked hard on the uneven, cobbled road, but soon enough they reached a smoother surface.
So what's happening tonight, boss? Sinzuela?
No, Charlie said.
Drive me home.
10 minutes later, they were outside Sports Park, where Charlie had his penthouse. He looked over at the palm trees on the other side of the road, where the dark Audi had been parked in the past few days, the car that had sped off outside Sensuela the evening before. Charlie hadn't seen it this morning. The car didn't belong to any of his competitors in the area, but according to Freddy and the police, it had been reported stolen a couple of weeks ago. Charlie didn't like it. Something was brewing. Chapter 29. There was a wailing sound. Something pressed, pushed. Him? Henning wandered in and out of a fog that seemed to be alive. His chest was gurgling, his head ringing. It was night, no, day or evening. Every time he opened his eyes, the light changed. He felt nothing, realized that he was being lifted out of a flashing blue car down onto the ground. The wheels rattled as someone pushed him into a building and along a corridor where long yellow and white arrows flashed above him. He tried to lift his hands. Couldn't. Tried to swallow, but it only left a dry, metallic taste in his mouth. He was turned over. It felt like floating. He was cold, could hear voices around him, urgent voices that spoke in some sort of code that he couldn't understand. They went down what must be another corridor, through a door, into a room where the light was even brighter. Then he lost all consciousness, didn't even notice that everything went dark. When Henning came to, he realized where he was. He was in hospital. He couldn't feel any pain, not in his arms or legs. For a moment he was scared that he'd been paralyzed, but then he managed to move a finger, then an arm, pulled it out from under the covers and lifted it ever so slightly. So, this was what it felt like, to be shot. A nurse opened the door and smiled. He wasn't even sure if it was a man or a woman, he just saw a white figure moving. He or she said something that Henning didn't catch. He heard a tap being turned on. The nurse's smell reminded him of something, but he couldn't remember what. He closed his eyes. Durim Redzepi had tried to kill him. Again. Henning attempted to push himself up, but he had no strength in his right arm. He tried with the other, only just managing to lift his upper body, and ended up lying on his side. "No, no, 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 you mustn't do that," the nurse said. "Lie down again." Henning didn't lie down. He focused on the nurse who came over to him. It was a woman, long brown hair in a ponytail, about 30, kind eyes. She helped him to settle back down. "You were incredibly lucky," she said. "The bullet went in here," and she pointed to a spot just below her collarbone, "and out the other side." "Lucky," Henning thought. "Yes, perhaps. There's a major artery just below the collarbone, the subclavian artery. If you'd been hit there, well, then it could well have been a fatal wound," Henning thought. She gently moved his leg. "We opened the wound and cleaned it, gave you a tetanus injection so you won't be able to move your arm much for a while. It'll be very stiff because of the bleeding in your shoulder joint. You will gradually regain feeling, but we've put your arm in a sling in the meantime, and we've given you some morphine for the pain." "That explains the drowsiness," Henning thought.
"Where am I?" he asked.
"Ullevaal Hospital," the nurse replied.
Is there anyone from the police here?
There's an officer just outside the door.
The nurse then turned around and sailed out of the room. Henning felt dizzy again and let his head sink into the pillow. He closed his eyes and immediately went back to sleep.
Chapter 30. Whenever he went to a hospital, Bjarne Brogoland thought of Alicia, his daughter, and the woman who had given birth to her. The labor had lasted for 42 hours, and the strain and blood loss had left Anita looking like a wan, worn-out heroin addict. It had taken her a long time to recover. Henning's room was at the end of the corridor on the third floor, and Bjarne showed his ID to the officer sitting outside before rapping on the door 3 times and going in. Henning barely opened his eyes when Bjarne sat down by the bed. Bjarne looked at him for a long time and then shook his head.
"I've known a few people in my time who had guardian angels," he said. "But you really take the biscuit. Have you been speaking to someone up there?"
He pointed to the ceiling.
"The next floor up?"
Henning asked, coughing. He blinked furiously.
"No, I haven't done much other than lie here."
Bjarne laughed. Then he was promptly serious again.
"Have you spoken to anyone since you were admitted?" "Anyone in the same uniform as you, you mean?"
Bjarne confirmed this with a nod. Henning gave a slight shake of the head.
"It was Durim Redzepi who shot me," he said.
His voice drawled. He sounded drowsy.
"Are you sure?"
Henning nodded slowly.
"He's not been caught, then?"
he asked.
"No one's been arrested," Bjarne said, shaking his head. "We found the car in flames at Everstad not long after, but no Redzepi." "There was someone else in the car, too,"
Henning said.
"A driver." "Did you get a look at him?"
Henning shook his head.
"Bet it's buzzing on the fifth floor right now. First Ivor, then me."
Bjarne didn't answer.
"Has the media got wind of the fact it was me who was shot?"
"Don't think so. Not yet, anyway." Henning nodded slowly again. They were both silent for a while.
"I can't stay here,"
Henning said. Bjarne had guessed Henning might say this.
"There are so many entrances to a hospital this size,"
Henning continued.
"Yes, but we're keeping a close eye on you, obviously." "So, one officer out in the corridor, that's your definition of keeping a close eye?"
Bjarne lowered his head.
"I can't stay here,"
Henning said again.
"I've got too much to do."
Bjarne gave him a stern look.
"You are not going to do anything at all. Not now, and not when you're better. You have to let us deal with this now. Someone is trying very hard to kill you, Henning."